I wanted to explore today and then also next week a theme related to the time of year that we're in, which is the time when we're coming into the greatest darkness and then the coming of greater light, the time around the winter solstice, around a lot of holidays related to light. The power of this time was so great that they were able to change the birthday of Jesus from April to December, according to scholars, to compete, I guess, with the ceremonies of light that were occurring otherwise. So interesting. So it's a very powerful time. Outwardly, the earth slows down. A lot of the processes of the plants, the trees, and so forth are more internal. There's a certain quiet time. And again, across most cultures, it's been a time of the appreciation and even celebration of the mystery of going into darkness and coming back into light. And we have these holidays. Again, like I say, Christmas was shifted. Hanukkah in the United States was shifted from a minor holiday to a major holiday to compete with Christmas. So a lot of interesting cultural phenomena going on. And also it's the time of Kwanzaa. We have New Year's. And it, you know, if we were following the rhythms of the earth, we would be like the earth. We would stop. We would slow down. We might have a break for a month or two, which was the case in many cultures. We seem to speed up often around this time, and I'm going to suggest that actually we can benefit ourselves as well as the larger culture by seeing if we can have a chance to slow down, take stock, look inwardly, have a period when we're not so frenetic. This is something that my friend and colleague Diana Winston wrote about like over 15 years ago. It was about the speed of contemporary culture, and I think it's gotten more extreme. So this is what she said. Contemporary America, we love fast things, fast cars, fast meals, microwaves, one-night stands, instant credit, overnight express, cable modems, amphetamines, pizza delivery, McEverything. And then she says, what did we do before email? So 15 years later, we know what we did after email, right? So I don't have time to write letters, read books, visit my friend, play with my little brother, kiss, touch, sigh, dance, relate, each ice cream, make music, cook, pray, smell, meditate, take a walk. My God, make it all stop. I don't have time, and it's running out, and I'm running fast and furiously, and I want it to stop. Ouch, it's painful. Why won't it stop? Can't you make it stop? My God, what's wrong with this country? Have we all gone crazy, or are we insane? We've lost touch. We've lost touch. We've got to stop this endless running about. All I want to do is slow down, just crawl into bed and rock myself to sleep. Not this craziness, not this crazy running about. I am so tired. Please, somebody, you have to, got to help me stop. Can anyone relate to that?
Yes.
And so the invitation of really the talk and of our time of year is to see if we can actually find a time to slow down and stop and not just go from one thing to another. I remember, you know, I taught in conventional universities for 7 years, and I remember teaching, I taught 4 years at the University of Kentucky. And I remember urging people at the end of a semester just to take a little bit of time to reflect or to pause or to see what they had learned rather than go instantly from one thing to another. And it was hard. It was going against the grain for them to do that. And so here we may be more inclined to find a time to, you know, to find even a few days, a week, to slow down, take stock, go within, look more deeply. That's going to be the encouragement of the talk. And again, some things are not in our control, but maybe things are. You know, I thought of the historian Arnold Toynbee said the mark of cultural creativity, when he looked across thousands of years of history, was where there were patterns of withdrawal and return. And I think that's true for individuals as well, where we can have patterns of some kind of withdrawal and some kind of return with hopefully more perspective to our lives. So I want to explore that topic today and next time and offer some specific ways that we might do this. And this is the encouragement is to do so while recognizing the crises of our time. If you were just looking at the outer crises, you might say, I don't have time to withdraw. I just need to, whatever, work on climate issues all the time or whatever, or work on choose it, your choice of 5 or 6 or 10 systemic crises that we're in the midst of, which I probably don't need to name, right? You know, that we know that they're there. And so what I want to do is explore, I think, 4 ways that we can respond to this time and find a way to stop, to gain further perspective, to, in a way, leave the busyness and the habits for a while and hopefully come back with more perspective and refreshment. And I know for myself, I teach 2 retreats right around this time. And so get myself, even as a teacher, to have a retreat around the winter solstice and also right after the winter solstice, the beginning of the new year with our metta, her loving kindness retreats. And I know that before I was regularly teaching those, I think for 25 years, I virtually always had a retreat over the New Year's. You know, that I would, we have one here, which is quite wonderful, and before I moved to the Bay Area, I would do retreats. And I remember some years I organized just informal retreats with friends and neighbors. When I first moved to the Bay Area, living in Berkeley, I helped form a group of neighbors. We just would meditate with each other every morning. And we formed, you know, over several years, we had New Year's retreats. I think they were 3 days long. We just did them in other people's houses, you know, and no expenses beyond, you know, beyond not working. And they're very wonderful just to stop for a period of time. So I want to explore the themes of, first of all, stopping, which I've already started, so to speak. And also the theme of how when we, at this time of year, partly to stop is to go into the dark. It's one of the themes. What does it mean to go into the dark? And I want to explore that as in terms of stop, not only stopping, but also some related themes, like going into the dark can mean going into difficulties. It can also mean going into what we don't know, going into unknowing. It can mean also going into darkness, much like the earth. It means to go into what's about to be born. What we can see the darkness as generative and fertile as well, and also as actually producing light and the luminous, what's powerful and inspiring in that way. So I'm going to primarily talk about the darkness in terms of stopping, in terms of difficulty, in terms of not knowing, in terms of being generative, and then I'll explore next week some of the others. So I'll see how far I get with this. So, and what I want to do is also to suggest practices that we could do over the next week or two that would help us to, even if we were not stopped in this time fully, to have periods of stopping and looking into some of the themes. So I want to really point to ways that we can bring these themes into our lives in the next 2 weeks. And I hope that it's clear that by talking about darkness, I'm really pointing to both, as it were, challenging or difficult aspects of darkness as well as positive aspects, that often in our culture, we only have negative connotations of darkness. We talk about the dark ages or a dark time, and we're primarily focused on the negative, and that's related to the way that we also historically have pathologized people who are darker. And so I think it's important to see that darkness has both, I don't know if positive and negative is the right way to talk about it, but it has aspects which are difficult or challenging on the one hand, and aspects which are generative and helpful on the other. So just to be clear about that, I think one of the dangers of spiritual practice is that we just get attached to the positive. We get attached to the light. We sometimes call this spiritual bypassing, where we just want to have wonderful experiences, not difficult ones. And, I've sometimes made this comment that even when I look at the promotional literature for Spirit Rock, I see, in my view, a little bit of an overemphasis on the positive. Maybe that's the nature of promotion. We don't say, come, learn about all your long-time neurotic patterns. Be mindful of them more than you care to. Right? For the sake of deep inner growth, which will take longer than you want. How many of you would have come to Spirit Rock if that was in the promotional literature? Right. So, sort of a change of attitude, partly. This is from the writer Michael Mead, who writes sort of about mythology and applied to contemporary times. He said, "Those who would know the world and recover the dream of life must pass through the darkened center, traveling where no ideology can know the meanings in the human soul. Here, success and speed are an encumbrance. It is better to move carefully and examine whatever appears. On most days, America fears the darkness. The open 24-hour signs and lights always on say that the rejection of darker people says that, the win at any cost dogma says that, yet always climbing to the top and rising to the light casts an increasing shadow over the world and loses touch with many things that the earth darkly knows." I remember when the great Thai teacher Achan Cha first came to the US quite a while ago, and he was very struck by the lights that were always on, even though this was like 30 years ago. And he said, "There are just so many lights." He said, and then after he had been here for a while, he said, "More outer light, less inner light." Right. So he was interesting observations from someone who lives in the forest in Thailand. Right. So the first theme, going into the darkness as a form of stopping, and again, this is really to, in a way, be like the earth. Be like the earth, which stops, and at least stops outwardly, probably inwardly, biologists would tell us there's incredible action occurring, right? There's incredible action getting ready for the spring. And I think we can be like that, but can we find again a place to stop, even just for a few days, finding ways to stop? And we can do this externally, and internally, we do it in our practice by continually coming back to the breath and letting the mind get less busy. One of the meanings of our practice is that we learn to let the really overactive mind, for many of us in this culture, quiet down and even come to a stop through that, the practice of coming back to the breath or whatever the anchor is, coming back over and over and developing more stability of mind. And one of the marks of long-term practice is that the compulsive thinking really winds down, that the overthinking and the mind being more active and almost like out of control really shifts. You know, I've been practicing for 40 years, and I think the level of my thinking is probably about 20% of what it was 40 years ago. 40 years ago, I was a student, so I was supposed to be thinking all the time. But it's about 20%, I think, quality of the thoughts much higher. So less thinking, better quality. Put that in the promotional literature. Right? So less thinking. Yeah, I just thought that for the first time. So. Very good. So we need to have a certain level of internal stillness and stopping just to listen to what's there. Right? That we can't listen to what's deeper if the mind is overly active. Again, one of the reasons that we need both that external stopping and also the internal stopping. This is from the poet Rilke. All creation holds its breath, listening within me, because to hear you, I keep silent. We need to have that kind of inner silence. And I like to sometimes think paradoxically that we need to have a certain amount of inner stopping in order really to, after we've stopped, to move, to really move in creative ways, to stop, listen deeply, and find out what the next step is, where our next movement is. So the second theme related to the darkness is about seeing the darkness as the difficult. That's probably the usual connotation, a difficult or painful time connected with the darkness. And really, again, one of the powerful qualities of our practice is that we learn to be with what's challenging or difficult rather than run away from it. You know? And we do that especially when what's difficult is in the workable range. Because when we talk about being with the difficult or the challenging, again, as a point I often make, is that we can't really be mindful very easily, most of us, of what feels like too much or overwhelming. And so we need to, first of all, have a number of different ways of coming back to balance when things are too much or too difficult. But then when things are in the workable range, we can actually be present and be mindful. And so again, one of the hallmarks of our practice is that we find ways to have skillful responses to what's difficult. There's a beautiful teaching in the traditional text called the teaching of transcendental dependent arising. And one of the core points of that teaching is that our practice totally changes and moves towards liberation when we work with the difficult in a non-habitual way. What's our habitual way of working with the painful or the difficult? We try to push it away, and we try to maybe latch on to something positive, but we especially push it away, don't want to deal with it. You know, and this is really right at the center of our practice, is learning not to do that, which is not easy. So for some of us, when we first practice, it means learning to be with unpleasant sensations in the body. Again, if they're not causing damage and not overwhelming, we learn to be with knee pain or shoulder pain. And again, it's not in the promotional literature. Come, be more than you'd like with your shoulder pain and learn amazing things. I think that's really true. Anyone relate to that? That there's some truth to being with the unpleasant, right? That we can actually learn essentially how conditioned we are to want only the pleasant and push away the unpleasant, right? It's very deep in our culture, right? Very deep in the culture, and we have that conditioning. And so one of the most powerful aspects of the practice is learning to be willing to open to what's difficult or painful and have skillful ways of doing that, you know? And to, again, the teaching is that when we actually push away the unpleasant, when we're reactive towards the unpleasant, it's as if we shoot an arrow at ourselves or others. We have that favorite teaching of mine called the teaching of the two arrows, which is that we could speak of having something difficult or painful as being like we're shot by an arrow. And the teaching is that if we're not skillful, we will shoot a second arrow at ourselves or others because of the pain of the first arrow. And that's very unskillful. And so we would, when we have unpleasant physical sensations, we will tense around them. We will try to make them go away. You know, in the culture, we might take drugs more than we need to or more than that is wise. You know, and we often tense around the pain. I've often made the comment that doctors have said that a large part of the chronic pain, of many types of chronic pain, not all, is the reaction to the chronic pain, that as much as 80% of chronic pain isn't the initial stimulus, but it's the reaction to the pain, the tensing. You know, not to mention the mental comments, you know, this will last forever, or negative comments about self or about others. And we know that shooting of the second arrow also, when we someone does something or says something negative to us and we immediately react back with the negative. That would be an example of shooting the second arrow. Something difficult happens to me, I blame myself, I blame someone else, and that narrative can last for weeks or months or years, right? And so what we learn to do by opening to what's difficult is we learn not to shoot the second arrow. Really key, really central. Not easy, right? Not easy to do. So we need to learn a whole set of skills to do that internally, to do that externally. What do you say when someone comes to you with a negative comment? Do you instantly repeat back a negative comment? So again, it's a whole area that we've sometimes explored here about how we have skillful speech. How do we not shoot the second arrow? How can we be with something difficult or painful? And again, we have a lot of habitual tendencies, and part of our practice is to notice those. Notice what those habitual tendencies are. And so, initially, we learn simply to be with the unpleasant in meditation. Can I be with unpleasant thoughts or emotions and just be with them? Watch my tendency to want to push them away. There's a cartoon which I like a lot, which I sometimes mention here. It shows a young meditator sitting on the cushion saying, today, I will live in the present moment. Unless the present moment is unpleasant, in which case, I will eat a cookie. And so here we hang out with the unpleasant some first and eat the cookies second. Okay, not saying don't eat the cookies, but we learn how to be with the unpleasant. So this is part of this rhythm of learning to be with what's difficult, which is so crucial. And again, I think I probably learned this first coming to this practice, that there was an alternative other than simply reacting to the unpleasant, and that we can actually be skillful with the difficulty. And so we really have to study all the patterns by which we're reactive. We study, what are my habitual patterns when something difficult comes up? Again, it's very helpful as we're doing this also to work with the practices which go to beautiful places. We have our loving kindness practice, our various heart practices. We have practices where we can be with beauty, with kindness. And I think especially if we have a lot of difficulties, it's really crucial to be spending a lot of our time just hanging out with what's beautiful to give us balance as we also are with the difficult. So if we're in a stretch where we're looking at a lot of difficult or painful or challenging mind states or situations, deliberately spend time with the beautiful, whether it's the trees or the forest or the ocean or art or music. And so to be with the difficult, we need to often, if it's there a lot, we need to also be with the wonderful and the beautiful, or it gets to be too much. We get a little bit out of balance. And so that's a really crucial point. Zen teacher John Tarrant says, "The courage with which we bear our own darkness frees others from having to carry it for us." Interesting, isn't it? Right. So really, really a crucial dimension of our practice. Can I really be with what's difficult? Can I do it with my meditation? Can I say, oh, something difficult, it seems workable. Can I be with it and be interested? What's it like when I'm with unpleasant sensations in the body? What's my mind doing? What's really happening? Can I have interest in that? Can I have interest? Oh, I have anger. Can I study anger? Can I be with it? Can I investigate it? You know, one of the most illuminating retreats I ever had was when I was angry for most of the days, for 10 days in a row, and I had good guidance, and I studied my anger for 10 days. And it was in the workable range. It wasn't like totally out of control. It was in the workable range. It was kind of like a low boil for 10 days. And I was able to be mindful of it. And it was so amazing because it was workable. And I said, wow, look at that. Look at the anger. Look at, wow, I never saw anger like that. Wow, look at that. Oh, and I said, oh, look at that. And look, I really investigated. Oh, look at that. Beneath the anger, oh, there's sadness. I stay with the sadness. Beneath the sadness, oh, there's love. I thought it was just anger. Oh my gosh, look at that, amazing. And so this is the quality, the meditative quality that we call investigation. Really, really crucial for being with the difficult. And of course, when we can be with our own difficulties, we can also be with others' difficulties. It doesn't freak us out so much. When I've really studied anger a lot in myself, I can be with other people's anger and I say, oh, look at that. I recognize that pattern, rather than just going right away to the second arrow. Someone's angry towards us, we can more maybe have a sense of what's going on internally and not be totally hooked into patterns of reaction. So really, this is one of the hearts of our practice generally, you know, being able to be skillful with what's difficult. Kind of a related area is the third area I wanted to mention, which is being with not knowing, being with unknowing. This is, we could say, is part of what it means to be with the dark. Can I be with what I don't, with an area of my life that I don't know? Does anyone here have any area of your life that's unresolved? Raise your hand if you do. Okay, very good. So, about two-thirds. Okay, for the people who have their lives totally resolved, next week you'll be the teacher. Okay. But there's a wonderful place for listening quietly to what's there, you know, and a lot of times we get busy and we have unresolved issues. We have unresolved issues, and unless we have that stopping and the quiet, it's very hard to get at major unresolved issues that have some depth when our mind's really busy and active. It can often take that quieting down to really know the way to go, really to be able to listen carefully. I remember There's a great story from the life of Gandhi about a time in the movement for Indian independence. I think it was around 1929, when Gandhi didn't know what to do. He was in a state of unknowing, and people were coming up to him saying, "What should we do?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "What do you mean? You're supposed to know. You're Gandhi." Right? And he said, "I don't know." And he said, "I will just listen until I know." And he sort of stepped back from the Indian independence movement And he went back to his community. He lived on what he called an ashram, a community which was by the river. And he said, I'm going to sit on the porch of my home and do nothing and watch the river. And he did that, and people would come to him and say, what should we do? And he said, I don't know. I know I will hear the inner voice, but I have not heard it yet. And he listened and he listened and he listened. And he took, after 6 weeks, he said he heard something. And what he heard was that what would be valuable next in the independence movement would be to march to the sea and against the law that the British had, that had the people of India could not make salt from the ocean. He said, we will make salt. And so he began what was called the Great Salt March. Some of you probably have seen that in the film on Gandhi. And he started, I think, with 250 people, and they marched out from the ashram. And by the time they had got to the ocean, it was 10,000 people. And they started a campaign of making salt, which was committing civil disobedience. The British came down really, really harshly with a lot of violence. And in the international opinion, there was loss of legitimacy of the occupation. And many historians think that it was actually a turning point in the movement. And it came out of that waiting and listening and not rushing things and wanting really to have that voice of from the depths be heard. And I think this is very much what we can do, especially at this time, to listen carefully. So can we find that quiet that's necessary? And in a way, you know, when we would meditate for a period at this time, often, like I like to, when I go into a period of quiet, I try not to have an agenda. I try not to say, okay, I've got unresolved issues 1, 2, and 3. At the end of 3 days, they should be resolved. Inner voice, please do your work. Doesn't work like that, does it? It's more that we go into a period of quiet, and we, in a sense, have a certain amount of trust that what comes to our attention will be what we need to learn, even if it's not what we think we want to learn. It's interesting, right? Do you know that one? Right, that we have to listen, and sometimes we'll get something coming that we didn't think was there, and our major unresolved issue actually may not get resolved, but maybe something else comes to our attention. And so a lot of our practice really depends on a certain kind of faith or trust or confidence in the unfolding of our experience, and that if we actually listen carefully as best we can, we'll get what is available at the moment. Maybe something else will come later. And so we have to be in a period of not knowing. We have to be able to stay sometimes with not knowing towards that which is unresolved. You know? I've thought about this principle of not knowing, and I'm kind of inspired by my colleague Diana Winston brought this principle of not knowing to a group of teenagers for a teen retreat. And they said, you know, not knowing is good, but you have to correct that. Not knowing by itself is not good enough. And they said, you have to say, not knowing, but keep going. And so that was like a very friendly correction, right? So it's not knowing, but keeping going. Even if sometimes keeping going, you have to stop. Okay, hope I'm not getting too confused with my metaphors. Okay. Let me see if I find there's... There is a beautiful passage in a book called Letters to a Young Poet that Rilke wrote to this young poet. Rilke was 29 at the time, so he was an old poet. The young poet was like 20. But he wrote letters to a young poet. And the poet, he wrote to this young poet that the poet was trying to resolve things too quickly. He had to be able to stay with what was unresolved in his life and listen over and over again and have the value of listening to what was unresolved and do that for a period of time and have that be a way of life, that he would listen to the questions. And he said, someday you may live into the answers, but for right now, live with the questions, live with the unresolved issues. And that was his counsel. It's a very beautiful counsel for not knowing. Then the last quality I want to talk about is the sense of being with the dark as also generating insight, knowing, something that's fruitful, that when we actually can be with the difficult or be with the unknown, when we stay with that, something comes out of the process. That when we can, you know, much like the example from Gandhi, that when we can stay with the unknown and look deeply, sometimes something unresolved or not known or difficult needs us to go to a deeper level. We can't resolve the issue with our present understanding. We have to come to some deeper understanding. And so being with the darkness as the difficult, the unknown, can be generative or fertile, can lead to insight and transformation. You know, I thought of my father, Simon, became blind when he was younger than 50 years old, probably the result of unsupervised experiments as a chemist working for the government. But he was not really bitter. And he was blind and had to stop driving, had to really change his work. He was blind the last almost like 30 years of his life. But something opened up in his blindness. I found that there was almost like more emotion, more kindness, more love was a fruit of that. You know, it was very interesting. He couldn't really, so much of our view of other people comes through the vision, doesn't it? Interesting that he could be with people and they would know he would not judge them because of how they looked. Isn't that interesting? I mean, and it's very interesting. So he would be with them in a way that was really different maybe from how other people were. And I found there was like this opening of his heart as he couldn't see, as there was a loss, as he was with something that was difficult. And there's actually, you know, in a lot of cultures, blind people carry the wisdom of the culture. You see that, I know you see that in ancient Greek culture. There was a figure named Tiresias who was blind but carried the wisdom of the culture. In a lot of cultures, those who are blind, they see, as it were, in a different way, which I think my father could do. He could see in a different way because of the shift in his internal process. This is from the poet Rumi. Some nights stay up until dawn, as the moon sometimes does for the sun. Be a full bucket pulled up the dark way of a well and then lifted out into the light. And so there's this possibility, I think, of being with what's difficult, what things we don't know, and having that be generative of light. It's difficult because we don't know, and we may be caught in negative narratives. Oh, it's going to turn out this way. I think that's true individually. It's very true at this time in our culture, in our society, right? That we're in a time of a lot of unknowing and a lot of difficulty. You know, I know in meeting people, I meet a certain number of people one-on-one, and a certain percentage of the people I work with have been really triggered by the combination of the fires, the reports on climate change, and the political events, and are in a very difficult place, really, of really being negative, caught in negative scenarios. Things are just gonna be bad, right? And probably all of us have that at times. There's a term which I like a lot, which I've taught on some, which is the dark night of the soul. Do you know that term? Which was originally a term developed by the Christian mystic St. John of the Cross in like the 16th century. It was actually taken to be a more advanced stage of spiritual development when everything dries up and you don't know what's true and you're lost and it feels dry and arid, but you have to stay with it because it actually is a deep, it's actually a more advanced place of development, and out of that comes something actually much more beautiful and powerful than where you were before. And there are ways, I think, in which we're in a kind of a, something of a collective dark night. Does that resonate with you? There's a kind of collective dark night, and we don't know what will happen. We have all these crises that I didn't mention, you know, assuming that you know what I'm referring to. You know, whether, you know, the crises of the climate or economic inequality or the threats to democracy or the racism, or you probably could add a few more, but those are some of the major ones, right? And we have that. And there's a way in which it's a kind of a collective dark night. And I think that people who are skilled from their own internal practice of working with difficulties, working with the unknown, are the people that are incredibly needed right now. If you've worked with your own unknowing, if you've worked with your own difficulties, darkness in that sense, even if you've worked with your own personal dark night, you will be incredibly valuable if there's a period of a collective dark night, which I think we're many intimations that that's part of the process right now, that there are a lot of ways, you know, most of us maybe don't want to look too closely at things, but when we do, sometimes we may feel that. Does that resonate with people some? That there's a kind of a, and part of the what's valuable is knowing that the darkness is also generative. This is from an activist named Valerie Kaur, K-O-U-R. She says, breath, labor, or breathe, labor, push. What if this darkness is not the darkness of the tomb, but the darkness of the womb? What if our America is not dead, but a country waiting to be born? What if the story of America is one long labor? What if all of our grandfathers and grandmothers are standing behind us now, those who survived occupation and genocide, slavery and Jim Crow, detentions and political assault? What if they are whispering in our ear tonight, you are brave? What if this is our nation's great transition? Breathe, labor, push. Interesting. Interesting perspective. This is from the Sufi poet Hafiz. I wish I could show you, when you are lonely or in the darkness, the astonishing light of your own being. Right? So, again, the invitation here is to study our own not knowing, our own difficulties, and that doing so is not only valuable personally, but makes us capable of working with those phenomena at a group level, at a national level, at an international level, that if we can be skilled in knowing what it is to be with difficulty, if we can know what it is to be with the unknown, if we can see that value of sometimes stopping and coming back to our coming back to doing nothing as a way of generating new growth. If we can know that the difficult and the periods of unknowing can be generative, can lead us into further insight. That's exactly what we need in our time, I think. And so my invitation would be, take this as a practice for the next week. When the difficult occurs, say, oh, invitation to practice, not just, not to, as it were, curse the difficulty, but to take it as an invitation to learn, to take this moment, this difficulty, to bring practice to it. So my invitation would be, see which of these approaches resonate. Consider having a period in which you stop, even if you just stop every day for a little bit. That's part of the practice. Consider saying when you have a moment of difficulty and it's workable. Again, when it's not workable, when it's too much, we have to have ways of coming back to balance. A lot of different ways to do that. When it's workable, it's not totally overwhelming. Can I be skillful with the difficult? How do I do that? Do I do that internally, interpersonally? But let me take this as a challenge. Let me take this as my practice. You may want to say, okay, every time I experience a difficulty or what's unpleasant in the next week, I'm going to say, oh, a time for practice. Wonderful. How's that sound? And remember, the way to really balance the difficult is to also deliberately go into the beautiful, the wonderful, the beautiful qualities of heart and mind. So if you take on the practice of being with the difficult, you also have to, every day, be with the wonderful. Okay? So if you take this on every day, spend a certain amount of time with beauty. Again, could be the beauty of the world outside or inside, could be the world of art, music, dance, whatever. So if you take on the practice of being with difficulty, you also take on the practice of regular times with beauty, okay? And you could also take on the practice of being with the unknown, of sitting, and really let this be part of the inspiration for your daily practice, if you have a daily practice, that you can take at the beginning of it, let me be with the unknown. Let me be fresh with the mystery of this coming moment. So you can actually say right at the beginning of a meditation, let me be with the mystery. How many of us sometimes in our meditation just try to, let's just get to that pleasant state that I knew from yesterday or the day before. Let's just have a pleasant, calm experience. Okay, that has its value. But can I actually say, let me be with the unknown, the mysterious, and be fresh to whatever is occurring? And have that be at the beginning of one's practice. So I'm going to end with, again, one of my favorite poems. This is from Pablo Neruda. If each day falls inside each night, there exists a well where clarity is imprisoned. We need to sit on the rim of the well of darkness and fish for fallen light with patience. That's our practice. We need to sit on the rim of the well of darkness and fish for fallen light with patience. So thank you. And how many of you would like to take on some element of what I've talked about in the next week? Okay. It'd be great. And why don't you reflect right now, what's the best way for me to do that? Could be one of the suggestions I made, or maybe something that just occurs to you. So thank you, and we have about 10 minutes or so for any questions, discussions, stories. Anyone want to share or ask a question? Yeah, so we have one right up front.
Yeah,
wait for the microphone.
What you said. said deeply resonates with me about going into the darkness and fishing for that light and so much of it. I feel like sometimes I do feel like I'm very good at taking the high road, but I do feel like I get exhausted taking a high road, and I'm wondering if you have any insight on that.
Do you want to say more what you mean by taking the high road?
Well, if I'm faced with a lot of negativity, I won't go there.
Yeah.
You know, I won't get involved, I'll witness it and everything, but there's part of me that gets exhausted that I'm staying at a certain level.
Yeah.
And not getting, and not, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe just not saying, who the hell do you think you are?
Yeah.
Or whatever, just staying present and mindful. And whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a wonderful question. And it really points to sort of the complexities and challenges of taking this approach, particularly, I think, interpersonally with speech. A lot of it is going to really be there with what's your motivation. And I think sometimes it is skillful to kind of respond sometimes matching the energy that's there. But it really is a matter of like knowing what's going on internally. So I think what you're pointing to, particularly with the example of you get negative energy coming towards you, this is sort of like advanced practice and probably higher level of complexity than what it is to work with this when it's you're in meditation. So I just want to make that comment that it's a quite challenging aspect of things. And it can be really helpful. I mean, I co-teach retreats on speech and mindful communication. And in the retreats, we do role plays where people practice being with difficult interpersonal situations. It's a hell of a lot of fun. But you get to try out and say, okay, where am I coming from? So you might even try it out with a friend. Do some role playing. That might be a way to explore, because you're really wanting to explore, is there a way that I can not totally give in to my habitual energy, but sometimes respond not simply by saying, I don't know what you say, but is there a way of responding skillfully and somewhat matching the energy, you know, of the situation? But a lot of it's really like, where am I coming from? Can I have enough presence of mind to say, I'm going to try to keep the sense of connection and compassion there? And what would be a skillful way of response where I simply don't withdraw, let's say, because I'm hearing that's a tendency, right? And challenging to explore that. Maybe try it with friends, do role plays. There are a lot of, you know, there are a lot of possibilities. One way sometimes is to actually try to go to empathy and try to have a sense of, oh, that really sounds hard and painful for you. So you're not withdrawing, but you're actually meeting the person. Not easy. Easy, way easier said than done. But there are a whole range of options. And I think your question comes from the sense that, sensing maybe that there are some other options in which you would keep your integrity of not just simply reacting, but could explore some other possibilities. So it's another time we can go into that in more depth. You know? But it's a good question, really important question. Not just in terms of personal response, but in terms of responding to the world, right? Yeah.
Yes, I can relate to what she's saying, and I'm wondering if you're dealing with someone who continually shoots the arrow.
Yeah.
And you're continually not shooting the second arrow. If you're dealing with someone who really relishes shooting the arrow and possibly sees your non-compliance with the scenario as weakness, there's the fear that it will go on into infinity.
Right.
This kind of...
Right. Does anyone relate to this question?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Really two responses. One of them is to know... that On a scale of degree of difficulty from 1 to 10, we're talking now about the 8s or 9s or 10s. And that a real, you know, part of, in any training, part of how we learn to be with the more difficult situations is to work with all these principles with less difficult situations. In other words, to work with your meditation where it's maybe a 6, and you're working with it internally, and you can see how you respond internally, or try to work with a situation maybe with another person where it's not an 8 or 9 or 10, but maybe it's a 5, but similar dynamics, and see how you could work with that, because we develop the capacities by working where the situations are not as hard, where they're easier. That's how we really develop the muscle. Every form of training works on that principle. If you only exercise these capacities with the really difficult things, it'll be too much, and we really won't learn. I'm not saying that's what you're doing, but just a reminder of that. And then, how to respond when someone is being continually reactive to you. It depends on the nature of the relationship. For some people, you may not want to be in relation to that person. In some situations, it might be a family member or a neighbor or someone, a coworker, where you don't have that choice, right? And so what to do then? I think very helpful to study your own reactions and to study your own. There's a lot we can do internally. The basic response I'm giving is, with those pretty difficult situations, think of what you're doing as having two major areas of practice. One is how you work internally with what comes up, and secondly, how you respond and work externally. And don't forget the first, because the other person is clearly reactive and so forth. So we always want to do the first, which means to look at how it comes up in our meditation, maybe do some inner work with it. I taught last weekend, or was it? No, the weekend before, I taught a 3-day residential retreat on transforming the judgmental mind. We also brought in the perspective of Byron Katie, who has some very valuable tools in which we, even where the other person is clearly reactive, we may have a lot of stuff that we can look at ourselves. And one of the perspectives you can have is that if you have to be in relation to this person, that you have the capacity for advanced learning. And you can thank you so much. I wouldn't be learning these advanced capacities without your reactivity. Thank you so much.
They call that
what?
Positive reframing of a negative experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, you can do that nationally. Yeah. But again, that's so being with these really difficult situations, I don't want to only focus there today, but it's really a very rich area, please.
What is the name of that Naruda poem?
Oh, let's see. What was it? I don't have a name for it, but if you use the first two lines, you can probably find it online. I found it in a book from a friend of mine named Ruth Gendler, who had an anthology of poetry called Changing Light, which you can buy on our website. Okay, advertisement. Okay, but the first two lines are, if each day falls inside each night. So probably you can Google it and get it. Okay.
I guess I was kind of thinking when you were talking about being with the darkness.
Yeah.
And I was thinking of brain science and maybe cognitive therapy, I'm not sure, but I had heard like change a negative thought with a positive thought immediately in an action.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering, just on the brain science wise, like to, if you be with it too much, that maybe you're making a neural path down a negative path. I'm just kind of curious on that.
Yeah.
Or is it Yes, indeed.
That being with what's difficult?
Yes.
Yeah, we really want to, if I'm understanding where you're going with this, we really want to watch especially our habitual thoughts related to being with something difficult or unknown. We really want to be careful for, we could call it shooting the second arrow, times when something difficult is there and we create some narrative like this will always be this way. Or we want to watch those narratives. They're very likely to be forming in situations in which there's something difficult or we don't know. So we want to really be careful of that. And some positive framing can be quite helpful, like, I don't know what will come of this, but let me take this as that learning will come out of it. Can be very, very helpful. I think the attitude of our practice is to take everything as potential learning. Again, that doesn't mean sometimes we might say it is not wise to be with this person anymore. That's okay, right? This isn't being masochistic, but to take everything as learning. Maybe the learning is that I sometimes stay too long with people with whom it's not good to be with, right? That could be the learning, right? So to take everything as learning, watch out for reactive negative thoughts, particularly narratives, that because those are likely to form when something is difficult for us. It's a form of the second arrow. It could be being judgmental towards self or other and so forth. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, maybe last one, I think, then we'll finish.
I was just wondering if you could repeat the name of the poet that had the line about what if this is a womb and not a tomb?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it was an activist. I forget her website. Maybe some of you know. Valerie, first name, K-A-U-R, Kaur. Yeah. I think she has, I think it's, it has, the website has heart in the name. It's like, it's basically a website devoted to spiritually grounded activists. I think they're particularly from a Christian perspective, I think. Yeah. Great, so that was one of the easier questions to answer. So let's take a few moments and just to come back to that intention. What's your intention leaving? Again, it might be to take on as a practice to say, okay, I'm going to look into when I can have a time of stopping. Might be that. Might also be related to the next week of working with the practice of being with what's difficult, being with what's not known. And how might you do that? How might you also remember to do it? Maybe intentions in the morning. So we end with, in a traditional way, with what's called the dedication of merit. We offer the benefits of our time together, our practice here. We offer the benefits to ourselves, but we also offer the benefits to others, ultimately all others, so that we ultimately do offer the benefits to all beings, which includes us. So may you explore wonderful things and come back with wonderful stories, which we'll hear next week. Thank you.